This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
At an age when a lot of people are slowing down or have long since retired, Anthony Hopkins has started taking on some of the most ambitious projects of his career, and he is 83. In the last decade, Hopkins played King Lear for the second time. He's on HBO's Westworld. He played Pope Benedict in The Two Popes. He even played God, the Norse god Odin, in Marvel's Thor movies.
You are a vain, greedy, cruel boy!
And you are an old man and a fool!
Anthony Hopkins' new film, The Father, is ambitious, but it's still much more down to earth. He plays a man whose dementia is starting to make itself known, and it's getting the better of him. He's struggling to make sense of his shifting realities, and he's fighting with his daughter all the time, and she's played by Olivia Colman. Hopkins talked about the film with New Yorker staff writer Michael Shulman.
If you think Zoom greetings are usually awkward, you have never tried introducing yourself to a literal knight. Hi, Sir Anthony. I'm Michael Shulman. Nice to meet you.
Tony Hopkins. Hello.
Tony. Okay. Tony Hopkins gives one of my favorite performances of the year in The Father. The film is directed by Florian Zeller, who also wrote the 2012 French play that it's based on. Much of the action concerns Hopkins' character, who's also named Anthony, resisting his daughter's efforts to hire someone to help take care of him.
So if I understand correctly, you're leaving me. Is that it? You're abandoning me.
Dad.
What's going to become of me?
Obviously, this is very important to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be going. I really love him. And I can come back and see you often at the weekends. But I can't leave you here on your own. It's not possible. And that's why if you refuse to have a carer, I'm going to have to...
To what? To what?
You have to understand, Dad.
Anne, you're going to have to what?
So in The Father, you play a man who is in the throes of dementia. And one of the incredible things about the movie is that it places the viewer in this man's subjectivity. We're confused along with him. I'm so curious how you understood for yourself what that would feel like and what it would look like.
Well, fundamentally, what it is for me as an actor, starting that, I've never experienced dementia in my own family. My father didn't suffer. He died of heart disease. My mother died of old age, actually. She died at the age of 89. She had complications, but not dementia. But it is an extraordinary condition. When you have a great script screenplay writer like Christopher Hampton or Florian Zeller, who is, I think, a remarkable genius, Florian, made it like, as you say over here, a walk in the park. It was so easy. So my idea is that I try to explain them to younger actors when they ask me, how do you get into the part? Well, I said, I don't really. If you follow a superb screenplay, the language, it's a roadmap. And so you don't have to act. So it's very easy. And then you work with someone like Olivia, And it makes it too easy. You, acting's not required. Just go through the scenes as if, as normal. And I think because I'm now 83, I'm closer to that age, that dangerous age when it could happen. I hope to God it doesn't. That's why I play the piano and paint and read and learn poetry and stuff. But it was easy. It was easy. And every day was fun, although it's not a fun subject.
Yeah, in a way, the what he's doing the entire movie is coping with his denial that he actually has this problem. And there's a just an incredible scene at the end when he finally breaks down and kind of regresses into childhood. Really, he's calling for his mommy. It's so upsetting and heartbreaking. You said that this was a really easy movie to do, but that seems hard, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Well, let me put it this way. I've been doing it a long time now. I've been around a long time. And I found it, as the years have gone by, I found it easier to act, you know. But we used to have a forum out here of young actors, and I'd ask them questions. There wasn't an acting class as such, but, you know, and I could say to them is just keep it as simple as you can. Don't act too much. Just keep it simple. But I say, if you have to do a Stanislavski on it, or you have to do a Lee Strasberg, fine. But keep it relaxed and know the text. And as I said, with Christoph Hampton, who adapted Florian's play to the screenplay, it is a roadmap. You don't have to figure it out. You don't have to rewrite or anything like that. One thing I did gather was that Florian told me when we met, he said, the name is Anthony. I said, my name? He said, yeah. He said he wrote it for me. I don't know if that's true, but he said he did. And so he put my actual birth date in. And there's a scene in the office with the doctor when I say, she's date of birth. I said, Friday, the 31st of December, 1937. Now, I do happen to have that kind of mindset. I'm fascinated by days. But I wanted to, as a little bit of character, I said, can I add Friday? So I said, but why? I said, because I know the date. He said, okay. And I wanted to show the doctor, I'm in perfect control. There's nothing wrong with me. Friday. Mm. You got a problem with that? Friday, 31st of December, 1937. That is a man who is in control, but of course he's not. But he's been used to control all his life. He's a man who is a bit of a tyrant. He's not a bad man. He's just been a tough old father and impatient and irascible. And now finally he's losing control of it all. And the last scene is when, yeah, I'm losing all my leaves. Everything's falling away from him. That must be a devastating tragedy.
Well, it reminded me so much of King Lear, which, of course, you've played twice. I believe you played King Lear 30 years apart. But having played Lear twice, did that character inform this one at all? Was there overlap?
Yes, in a way. To go back to Lear, it was a remarkable experience working with Richard Eyre and Emma Thompson and Jim Carter. I played it 30 years ago. David Hare directed it, the author David Hare, at the National, and I was okay. I was okay. Technically, I was okay, but I was still too young, and I thought I could crack it. No, because then you had to have the old age problem. Well, I'm now 80. I was 80 when I played King Lear the last time, so it was easy for me. Tell me, my daughters, since now we will divest us both of rule, interests of territory, cares of state. Which of you shall we say doth love us most, that we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth with merit challenge? And what I wanted, and I'd worked it out, I thought, where did I go wrong before? Well, okay, I'm going to play him as a tough old soldier who has no love, or a love embarrasses him. He's a tough old warrior. He drinks with all his pals, and he's rough, and he even treats his favourite daughter. He doesn't like his two daughters, can't stand them. But his one daughter he loves, but he treats her as a boy. And he thinks he's free. Right, I don't need love. But in fact, it wrecks him, destroys him deep inside, because he's not allowing himself to feel as a human being. And when he comes to the end of it all, he says, I'm a foolish, fond old man. And he admits to himself, I've been foolish all my life, because I never loved. So this with... And I'm a bit like that in my own life, because my father's a tough old guy, you know. He's a baker, worked hard all his life. And wasn't a very touchy, but you drink up and smoke. And but he was a lonely man, and he was emotionally raw himself, especially in his weaker years. So that's what I brought to it, I think.
Yeah, well, one thing that this role has in common with King Lear, I'd imagine, is that they both need to be played by an actor of a certain age, and they're characters who are losing their faculties, but you need incredible stamina and skill to play these parts. You know, anyone who's seen your work over the past couple of years, like The Dresser and The Two Popes and The Father, can see that you are absolutely on the top of your game at 83. But I was curious if you have, if the process is the same for you in your 80s as it was, say, in your 50s when you were doing The Silence of the Lambs. Have you come up against any sort of just limitations of getting older that have had to, that where you've had to adjust how you work?
Well, I can't run now. My knees ache. Well, when I was at Silence of the Lambs, I was in great shape, but I still am at 80. I mean, I make sure of my diet, and I don't smoke, I don't drink, and all that stuff. And I remember working on the film with Lion in Winter with O'Toole and Catherine Hepburn, and she said to me, she said, always look after your health. Without that, you're gone. And I took that to heed. It took me a few years to get in through my thick skull. But I thought, well, I've got one life. But I think it's an attitude of mind. I do believe this. It's no good saying, by the time you play King Lear, you're too old to remember the lines. Well, that's a fallacy. You have to say, we've got a perfect memory. It's a form of self-hypnosis. And you may say, I can do it. And it's beyond positive thinking. I can do it. And I feel strong enough to do it. I knew that I had all the muscle to play King Lear in my way, without playing him with self-pity. And with the father, the same. You have to be fit. You have to be confident. You really do have to know what you're doing. This is what I do.
You recently marked 45 years of sobriety. Congratulations, first of
Thank
all.
You.
So that was, I believe, 1975 that you gave up drinking. Was it difficult to do that?
No, I tried to avoid the subject because I don't want to be boring about it. I'm not a preacher and an evangelist. If you can have a drink and have some fun with it, and fine. And I know people who, you know, they drink and they're fine with it. They don't have to destroy the furniture. I was not a good drinker. But I became addicted to it, and because it gave me some sense of escape, some sense of peace. But in the end, I thought, this is not helping me at all. This is just making me more uncomfortable. And, you know, I was drinking quite a lot. Well, it wasn't so much the amount, it was the what it would do to my brain and what it would do to my body. And I thought, one day, this is stupid. And it was done. It was over and done with. And that's 45 years of a new life. And it's funny because, you know, I used to drink it up with all the old actors and all those guys because that's what you do and that's what you did in those days. I went into the Salisbury pub in London once. It was about 15 years ago, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And I just looked in the Salisbury pub where I used to drink, and I just stood in the doorway. And the barman, he said, "Hello there." He said, "You're Anthony Hopkins." I said, "Yeah." "Oh, come in. If you didn't drink, I said, no, I tell you what, I'll have a tonic water." He said, "Oh, good." He said, "Did you?" I said, "Come in here." And I looked at all the brass and a beautiful pub with all the Victorian design. I said, "Sit down." And he said, "Give me a tonic water and a sandwich." He said, "You used to come in here?" I said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "I knew them all." He said, "Yeah." I said, "They're all used to come in here. All the famous actors would come in." I said, "Yeah, they're all dead now." And I thought, my God, they're all dead. I thought, God almighty, well, you know, brilliantly talented people who think, well, that's the way they did it. They burned the rafters. They touched the rafters of life. But in the end, I thought, well, I'm glad I didn't have to go that far.
Well, this era of British theatre, late 60s, early 70s, was an incredible time. You know, this was the same theatre scene that gave us Ian McKellen and Judi Dench, all these great actors. But you fled, essentially, as far as I can understand. You just got out of there. I think the story is that in 1973, you were playing the title role in Macbeth, and you left the production and you moved to Hollywood to be in a movie with Goldie Hawn. And at the time, you know, you were really coming into your own as a great Shakespearean thespian and all the rest. This seems like a pretty drastic, you know, left turn. You've said that you didn't fit into that scene. Can you tell me why? Why did you leave something that you were flourishing in?
Well, I think it was I dragged up from my past, from my schoolboy years, that I wasn't bright enough to do anything. But I had an instinct. I had a roughhouse, kind of ruffian instinct about acting. But I wasn't educated in such. And I didn't have the confidence. And people say I was a Shakespearean actor. Well, I did the Scottish play, as they say. And I just didn't feel I fitted in. And if you approach anything in life and you have doubts, and big doubts about yourself, somebody will pick up on it and they'll attack you. They do. They'll see it as a weakness. And I suffered that a little. And I remember directors saying, "No, Tony," talking to me like a child, and I would become volcanic with rage. That it goes back to that. And I remember one day, it was in January 1973, and something yet had gone wrong. And nobody's fault as mine, but I thought, I'm out of here, I'm finished. And I was doing a play, The Misanthrope, with John Dexter directing. And John was a savage director. And he would pick on me as his whipping boy. And one day I said, "Fuck you." And I left. And I was warned, I said, "You will never work again." I said, "I don't give a shit. I don't care." And I told my agent, as I'm out, he said, "You're crazy." I said, "No, I don't care." And I went off to do a film with Goldie Hawn in Vienna called Girlfriend Petrovka. And one day I came back to the hotel and my ex-wife was on the phone. She said, "Somebody's coming out to see you in Vienna tomorrow." I said, "Oh, yeah, who's that, John Dexter?" She said, "Yeah, John Dexter, the director." I said, "Why, are they going to find me? Are they going to sue me for..." He says, "No, he wants you to do Equus in New York." So I met John the next day, and he was a tough guy. He said, "So why did you walk out?" I said, "Because you're a bastard, that's why." And he said something to me, he said, "Well, now when I listen," he said, you're a much better actor than you think you are. Stop all this nonsense." So I went to New York, and it was the change of my life. It was the best of times and the worst of times, don't I? But it turned out that I was no threat at all to anyone, that maybe I'd mellowed over the years. And
yeah, it's funny to hear you describe yourself as a younger actor who was so full of anger, because you certainly seem very happy-go-lucky now. But
it wasn't so much anger. It was just being a young man, you know, when you, I meet young kids and you meet them. Of course, anger, there's nothing wrong with being angry or driven or aggressive. Yeah, fine. That's all part of being alive. Otherwise, we wouldn't survive. But as the years have gone by, I thought, drop the anger. There's nothing to be angry about. You know, you're lucky to be alive. And so that was a transformation that was slow. But that wasn't so much anger. It was just insecurity, fear, ambition, misplaced, you know, paranoid probably, all those things. But when you're young, that's what you have to accept. And I, you know, you see young kids today, they're full of doubts and insecurities. They try to be cool, you know, cool. And yeah. But you can see beneath the mask that they're not cool. They're as scared as anyone else is. And to admit that we are afraid is a wonderful freedom. To also come to the confession that we're insignificant, and that finally everything is important, but finally nothing is important. It's all smoke.
Tony, thank you so much for spending some time talking with me, and congratulations on The Father. I'm excited for people to see it.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you, Michael.
Anthony Hopkins. He spoke with the staff writer Michael Shulman. The film The Father is out this weekend.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.